Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hi, and welcome to All Things Policy. My name is Shambhavi, and I work on life science policies here at Takshashila. It has been a while since I have sat down with the oldest soul at Takshashila to have a heart-to-heart about some of the geekiest topics under the sun. So here I am with my dear friend Anirudh Kanisetty.
What's up, Doc?
And we are going to be talking about the most controversial thing ever, eugenics. So, the reason why we started talking about eugenics is because last week, an advisor at Downing Street, Andrew Sabisky, had to resign, post some of his slightly contentious comments that were made public. This guy has been alleged to say about how women Olympics are more similar to Paralympics than to men's Olympics, that African Americans have lower intelligence than white Americans.
Oh, this is getting better and better every second.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy. He's quite open about it. He had this. He was promoting this drug that is supposed to increase intelligence, but has been shown to also be fatal when given to children. And he said that the benefits of increased intelligence are probably worth the dead kid every year.
Wow. And right. this is, of course, what led to a famous British geneticist getting involved in the whole conversation, right?
Yes. So Richard Dawkins came in and he tweeted that you can abhor eugenics for ideological or philosophical reasons, but it works in cats and dogs, so it works.
As everyone knows, humans and cats and dogs are exactly the same.
Yeah, we have similar fertility rates and the same lifetimes. All of that adds up.
Indeed, we do. Yes, that all makes sense. So why exactly are we here, Doc?
Well, we are trying to figure out what kind of eugenics do we want, since that's the way we are going.
Yes, since that's the way that the world is going, let's figure out what kind of eugenic policy we want.
Yeah, this is the correct time, I think, politically in our country as well to have this decision.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it was just a year or two ago that a certain cultural organization affiliated to a certain political party was talking about sending out advisories to people about how to have tall boys with fair skin and blue eyes through the consumption of certain dietary products. So, yes, it is just the right
time. I thought it would be inter-caste marriages. I was like, if you want to have tall boys with blue eyes, you should marry a foreigner. Anyways, but no, let's get back to this seriously. Because the reason why there's a lot of concern about eugenics coming up right now is because we have also enhanced the techniques and the science behind doing gene editing. So we have a better understanding of how our genes function. And we have a slightly better grasp of how we can manipulate the genes to our own likings, right? The low-hanging fruit here is obviously disease remediation. So there are certain diseases that are caused by a single mutation or a single change in a gene. And we are quickly trying to make those tools that can help rectify that single change back to what is considered normal in a diverse human population. Which, if you think about it, sounds really good. So if you have thalassemia, for example, which is a monogenic disease, you could change that and then the child who suffers from thalassemia is no longer has to have blood transfusion, doesn't have to have all of the symptoms and fatigue which is associated with it.
And you can continue to marry within your caste?
Yes, you can. That's another thing that we need to actually discuss about gene editing being used as insurance and the moral hazards that may be associated with it. But coming back to eugenics, science has come a long way since the word eugenics was tarnished by the experience of a lot of countries in the early 20th century. And as people might want to believe that Germany was the architect of this, it really wasn't. This primarily started in the UK and the US.
Oh, our colonial overlords who thought that they had the burden of civilizing the rest of the world came up with a genetic theory to justify all this. What a surprise.
Yeah, but the length of your nose. The circumference of your head had a lot to do with how intelligent and capable and competent you are.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so this started, the theories of genetic superiority started with the UK and in the US. The US actually had institutionalized programs to take women, to sterilize women and make sure that at least people of certain classes did not procreate.
Jesus.
Yeah. This is something that Sabizki also actually said, that people should be considering permanent contraception at puberty to prevent the start of an underclass.
Sounds similar to what a certain Indian politician was doing in the 70s, I think. Right?
Yes, I wasn't born then. Huh. You know, you were already still in the office.
Yes. But these kids keep coming and going with their newfangled ideas.
Yeah, of course.
But it's quite interesting how it's always some rich tosh from the upper classes who decides that the lower classes have no right to procreate. So it's impossible to not see that angle in the condescension of people like this.
Yeah, and it is quite pervasive. I think people are doing it without even understanding the problems we face. So, for example, I was reading this book DNA by James Watson recently. And James Watson is obviously one of the team members who founded the structure of the DNA, on the basis of which we could have this entire field of molecular biology and genetics and can now manipulate DNA, right? And he talks about, he has been widely criticized to be a racist. He has been widely criticized for his views on Africans, saying repeatedly that they have lower intelligence than Americans and not taking into account the fact that they have had less opportunity to educate and get exposure as much as the Americans have, right? So he has been widely criticized for that. And in the book, he tries to make up for it by saying that, oh, but look, if you look at the IQ test, and Africans and African-Americans are doing poorer than the Americans are. And the argument that, well, the IQ tests were based on a certain kind of output, the IQ tests are based because they're based for Americans who have had a certain kind of opportunity, has something that has escaped his mind. And he has taken into account that he has been criticized, but he still does not understand what he has been criticized for. And I think that is a part of being of a privilege that we are really, really struggling with to accept and move on, right? I was watching this Marathi movie yesterday called Curry Biscuit. It has nothing to do with eugenics, but this movie is about this two kids, a brother and sister duo, born in poverty, and the girl is blind. And their mother dies telling the son is older. So the mother dies telling the son that you have to make sure that she believes that the young girl, Khari, always believes that she has a life of luxury. She shouldn't know that we are in poverty, that we live on the roadside. And so this guy always takes her up on a railway platform where it's windy and tells her we are sitting in a plane. Or he believes, he tries to recreate a lot of things around her because she cannot see. And she's never had the experience of being on a plane, right? She doesn't know what being on a plane is. So I watched the movie, it was a really lovely movie. And then I was reading some of the reviews of the movie. And people are like, how can anyone believe being on a railway platform that they are in a plane? And I was like, that's because you have been on a plane. You know that it is not the same because you have been on a plane. He has absolutely no clue. And I think that is a kind of privilege that we are just so used to. We cannot believe a life outside of that. But sorry, that was a complete digression from the actual eugenics topic. But
no, but I think that this idea that people live such different lives based on what their socioeconomic background can be is something that seems to have escaped a lot of these pro-eugenics people. And I think Dawkins himself is a great example of that. You mentioned earlier, Doc, how this guy says that, okay, you know, eugenics works in cats and dogs. Why can it not work in human beings? I'm quite surprised to hear that Dawkins would say something like that, because the guy literally, he's one of the biggest names in genetics. Do we really understand stuff like intelligence, height, and so on and so forth well enough to say that, you know, breeding certain kinds of people together will lead to better quality of offspring? First question. Second of all is, as you pointed out, the fact that IQ tests of various things are based on a certain standard, which is based on a very particular social group. IQ is just one example of that. But if you think about stuff like beauty, for example, right?
You hear that case of the Olympics, right, with the testosterone levels in women.
But yeah, so this is something that we've talked about between the two of us, and it's based on very particular constructs of gender, which again might seem absolutely logical and rational when somebody like Richard Dawkins says that, but you have to interrogate the biases, you have to interrogate the privilege and the fact that he's talking from a very, very particular bubble. And it's very important to think about the real social consequences that all this might have. Now, we have been obviously very sarcastic and have been leaning into the dark humor quite a bit up to this point, but let's try to just directly address the problematic views that are being put out and that are increasingly being normalized by this kind of behavior. First of all is the fact that what is desirable in a human being can vary widely depending on a particular cultural context. Second of all is the fact that these are shaped by dominant structures within a society. So I'm sure that a lot of you would have noticed that all of a sudden, every movie poster has a dude bro with gelled up hair and a man bun or a beard. Whereas if you had gone back to the 90s, all the Bolly heroes that you'd have seen would have had absolute clean shaves and probably like shoulder length hair and so on and so forth. So beauty standards change so radically across time. Now, of course, haircuts are something that don't necessarily depend on your genetics, but stuff like how many abs are seen as desirable, how high your cheekbones should be, all vary drastically, all of which we don't fully understand how the genetics of all these things work. So saying that this is the norm and that we should be kind of breeding ourselves towards it, or even worse, that we should be using gene editing technology to be pushing ourselves towards it, can have absolutely devastating social effects. So it's not going to be an equal society. Not everybody in, even let's say hypothetically we have a society where everybody has access to gene editing, not everybody is going to be able to access technologies of the same quality.
Yeah.
Not everybody is going to have the same ideas as to what is desirable. And most importantly is a risk that certain very loudmouthed cultural groups can say that this is what we think is normal, and because the rest of society is too disparate, too diffused, are not able to respond to that. And that means an entire generation of children who are traumatized by this. And I think that's a discussion that really needs to be had in India today because of particular regulations that are coming out.
Right. So we obviously are trying to explore gene editing in India, and we should, because we have a pretty high disease burden that gene editing might be able to impact. But the question really boils down to who gets to decide what gene editing applications are allowed and what are not, and what is the basis of that decision, right? So the current way that it is structured, we have the Review Committee on Genetic Manipulation, through which all applications have to go through for also for gene editing, also for genetically modified organisms. And then for gene therapy products, specifically, there's another subcommittee, which is a layer before the ICGM, that was formed in December through guidelines that the DBT has, which is the Department of Biotechnology, has put through. So we have two committees, which are primarily made up of scientists who are deciding on these applications. Now, the point is that they probably are the best people in India to figure out whether something is scientifically correct enough to be made, whether it has scientific maturity, whether it doesn't have off-target effects, whether it is not going to impact the health of a person or things like that. But what kind of moral or philosophical responsibilities they have in understanding what applications should be either promoted or should be disallowed is something that I do not understand. This is a broader conversation that we need to have. And I'm kind of the view that if an application is going to impact society, we need to have accountable people to make that decision on whether it's allowed or not. Whether it is an elected official, at this point of time, I don't think India's elected officials have have the expertise to be making these calls. But we need someone with a little bit more accountability than just an RCGM has.
There needs to be transparency in how that decision is taken. And especially, as you pointed out, if it has social consequences, then society needs to be consulted in decisions that could potentially transform the fate of future generations.
At a minimum, it has to be a diverse group. It cannot just be scientists and doctors.
Exactly. And there's also the fact that very often scientists in India might be coming from a particular sort of bubble. They might not necessarily think that the social consequences of these technologies are important, which is fine. And they're scientists. That's not necessarily their job. But they need to be people who are trained and qualified to think about this, to be involved in the decision. And most importantly, these kind of decisions need to be matters of public record. These kind of decisions need to be accountable in some or the other way to civil society, to the public sphere. We need to understand how these decisions are being taken, who is taking them, for what reasons. There have to be ways to roll it back.
Right. And I think this is particularly important is India's social context, because we have got so many diverse groups. So many economically diverse groups, socially diverse groups, religious differences. I think we need a lot more public education going on about this incoming of gene editing and what it can be actually used for. Like you were saying, we really don't understand intelligence factors so much. And there's a broader philosophical question here, because the idea that we can have eugenics on dogs and cats, the problem with that is that, A, they multiply much faster than we do. But also we are providing them with a confined environment, and we get to choose the parameters of that environment. So if you look at the idea of breeding and evolution, you're basically adapting to the environment. And it is easier to control something in a controlled environment than an environment such as ours. Till this point of time, through trial and error, nature was choosing the characteristics that were best suited for the environmental changes that nature had.
Yeah.
Now we are saying that no, we'll choose what we think is brilliant. It might not necessarily have anything to do with the environment. But let's see. So if we have a bunch of people saying that we want to live in the tropics, but we want to have fair skin, we might see skin cancer cases going up. Right? Because we're not the best suited for the environment in that case. But it is our delusion that white skin is preferable over dark skin, which is a social problem in our brains, which needs to be fixed before we start making any calls on what kind of gene editing is
good. And given humanity's wonderful record with solving social problems, I think that should make us a lot more cautious about these kind of clarion calls. It's very strange how societies respond to technology, right? On the one hand, you will have absolute Luddites who say, no, we will ban it. It threatens traditions and it threatens livelihoods and so on and so forth. And on the other hand, you have people like Mr. Sabisky, who are essentially calling for it to be used to push a very particular narrow-minded vision of what society should look like. What gave him the authority to decide that intelligence is what we find what is most desirable? What if empathy is more important to a society and to a well-functioning society? Then he'd probably have to be, by his own logic, sterilized.
But this is also... So people like Sabisky, I think at this point of time, it's very easy to identify that there's something wrong. There's an outlier in the bigger narrative currently existing, and so we should get rid of him, and he resigned, right? Our problem is that if you look at the German experience, right, it started off not so dramatic. We now know of the Holocaust and everything, but when it started off, it said that there are people who are disabled, there are people who are infirm, and for the broader benefit of the nation, we do not have enough resources to take care of them, so we will first put them in hospital. So first they put the infirm in hospital and kind of quarantine them. Then they said, if you're disabled, you shouldn't be reproducing as well. So that was the first step. The second step was to say that, okay, but you know what? You're not never going to reproduce. You're still draining nation's resources. So goodbye. Right? So that's when we started seeing the first murders happening.
Yeah.
And it was still supposed to be in this national cause. And people were okay with it because you're contributing to the nation. And you're saying that, okay, you're disabled, so you have to go. That slowly started transfiguring into this idea that, Jews are bad. Jews have been draining the nation. So let's start taking the Jews away and then let's start getting the Jews. And that morphed pretty subtly over time. And because it was gradual, people were kind of getting, okay, this is the new normal. Okay, this is the new normal. This is the new normal. Till this whole thing happened, I think it just went out of hand. Right? That is the danger with gene editing. Because even we are saying that, okay, gene editing for health is good, we should be doing this, but that's the start. How do we make sure that we are not on a slippery slope where someday some guy comes in and says that, oh, you know what, you have been doing gene editing for health, it works, this is brilliant, now let's start doing it for intelligence.
The only answer is to have conversations like this, I think. No technology can ever be separate from a social context. And no social context can be separated from the fact that there will always be certain groups that are more powerful, that have platforms, that have control of the media, that are able to push particular ideas, which is why you need to have a pushback from other sections of society, which is why you need to bring all this stuff out into the open, which is why you need accountability and transparency in decisions that are going to affect the rest of society at large. The RCGM, for example, absolutely must be expanded. You need to have a more diverse group of people, not just in terms of professional backgrounds, but also, I think, in terms of socioeconomic backgrounds, who are able to grapple with the fact that an application of technology is not a black and white thing. You are not either a Luddite or somebody who's willing to use a technology to bring humanity into a new utopia. But you need to be able to interrogate the fact that these unconscious or conscious biases might always be at play in the way that these technologies will be used. The marginalized must have a voice in all this. Like, if for example, the Germans had disabled people who are on these committees, mm-hmm. I don't think that they would have been anywhere near as dismissive about the potential that these people might have in terms of contributing to the nation. And of course, like, I have my own philosophical objections to just the way that nations are being defined now as these very unitary, one language, one people, one leader sort of narrative, which are all things that don't gel with the underlying democratic values and constitutional values of a lot of countries, but that people are still going along with because, as I said, control of the media can matter a lot. And these are all things that I think we should be aware of as citizens. These are all things that we should be able to call out when we see our leaders discussing. And these are things that we should be able to call out in our near and dear ones. And most importantly, I think, even though Shambhavi and I are the resident geeks at Takshashila, there should be more of us. Technology should not be seen as this magical black box sort of thing into which you dump problems and solutions come out.
Yeah.
But as something that should be discussed and understood and then seen as not a magic wand, but as a tool that, like every other tool that humans come up with, can be used for good or can be used for evil.
Yeah, and I think particularly for generating, a lot of people are circumspect because they're like, this is, we don't understand this. This is probably not going to affect us. But just think about this as another tool to improve human life. And if I came to you today and said that I can give you a tool to magically make you better, what kind of objections would you have? What would you use the tool for? What would others use the tool for? And start having that conversation to begin with. Because really, now is the time that we need to have this conversation, to have more education, to have more engagement, to make sure that any social issues that could compromise the technology are stamped out.
Yep. And if not stamped out, at least brought into the public discourse.
Yeah. Awesome. That was very insightful, Anirudh.
Thank you, Doc.
Old person.
Thank you for being here.
To keep listening to more episodes of All Things Policies. Thank you for listening.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.